It's Friday afternoon. We've locked the door because someone suggested that downtown is a complete and utter wasteland. I mean, just like Mad Max style. We walk through it every day and it's pretty much the same as it's always been, but our Facebook feed couldn't possibly be lying to us, could it? And also because it's time for another edition of our weekly podcast, Tales from the Brown Desk. I'm Jake Rigney of Rigney Law, LLC. With me, as usual, is my law partner, wife, and future Michigan visitor, Cassie Rigney. She's leaving for vacation without me today, guys. Just me and the daughter at home, chilling, watching 23 hours of cartoons. It's going to be great.
Eleanor says she wants to play Raid.
That's right. Nothing but tablet video games. That'll be fun. Our host is Terry Ulm. Friendly reminder, Tales from the Brown Desk is a free-flowing conversation involving two foul-mouthed attorneys. It may include graphic descriptions of sexual activity, violence, and Yiddish. It may not be suitable for children, preteens, adolescents, emos, screamos, Robert Smith lookalikes, fans of The Cure, and Depeche Mode tribute bands. These jokes were better.
They were.
Maybe I don't need writers. Listener discretion is advised. Here's Terry.
Hello, everyone. Hi, Jake. How are you today?
I am poorly shaven, Terry. How are you?
Poorly shaven.
Yeah, look at my, like, all this disaster back here that I just missed while I was shaving.
Good thing you have a mask. Really bad. Covered up.
Yeah, most of the time people just can't tell, but I can tell. I know. And that's the most important thing.
It is. Hi, Cassie. How are you today?
I'm excellent.
Good. So today we're going to continue our series, A Walk Through the Criminal Justice System in Indiana. Last week we talked about negotiations and plea deals in criminal cases. And this week we are going to continue our adventure through the swamp and take the next step.
Part 12.
Yes, of 72.
I think it's going to be more like 84 episodes. We're behind schedule at this point.
We are. But before we continue our journey, we have a listener question.
Oh, I love it when we have listener questions.
Me too.
I do too. So a listener from Fort Wayne who prefers to remain anonymous.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's okay.
That's all right. Good plan.
Yep. He said he was arrested while protesting.
Oh.
He said that once he was inside the jail, he was beat by police officers. Mm. Or by officers, not police officers. The officers in the jail. And he wants to file a suit and wants to know what the statute of limitations is and what kind of attorney will he need.
Right. So if he or anyone intends to sue a state, the city, or any sort of officer who works for a state or a city or a municipality, they have 6 months to do that. So the statute of limitations is much shorter. It's based on Indiana law. I think, pretty sure it is. And you have to file a notice of intent to file a tort claim. I do not practice that type of law, so I hesitate to go much further than that. I know those rules, and that is about all I know about it. He should contact a civil litigation attorney, a personal injury attorney, or an attorney that works on civil rights matters. Because we are almost exclusively criminal defense here. So I don't want to say too much else about it because I don't like to talk about things I don't know very much about.
Yes. Cassie, do you have anything to add or do you think Jake answered that pretty well?
Jake answered that perfectly.
Banging yo.
Gold star. So we will continue our series. We're just going to do a short recap. So far on the series, we've discussed investigations, arrest, screening, the initial hearing, the discovery phase, bond review hearing, the review of counsel hearing, pretrial conference, talked about suppression hearings, negotiations, and plea agreements. And now we're taking the next step. To me, I think the next step might be a trial, but is there anything else that we missed or I missed?
Well, I mean, you can get down into sort of some of the nitty gritty stuff like instructions and motions in limine. things like that. But the next big thing, the next thing that a person could watch and sort of understand what's going on, is the trial. Yeah, if there is one. Now, obviously, if there's been a dismissal or a plea agreement, then you're not having a trial. But those cases that aren't resolved one of those two ways, they go to trial.
Now, does every defendant in a criminal case have the right to a trial?
Absolutely. Public and speedy trial.
When you say speedy trial, what do you mean by that?
365 days, maybe as short as 70 if you're in custody on a state case. But those aren't raw numbers. I always call it lawyer math. It has to be those amount of days attributed to the state. So, I mean, you can't go in and continue it over and over and be like, hey, you didn't meet your deadline, state, because you are the one that caused those delays.
So it's my understanding that there are two different types of trials. You can have a jury trial or a bench trial.
Yep.
Any other types of trials?
I'm pretty sure they got rid of trial by combat. So I think it's just those two now. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that one died.
Yeah.
So with the jury trial and the bench trial, can you explain to our listeners the difference between the two and if one is better than the other?
The first part of that is pretty easy. The second part is much more complicated. And the other thing you have to remember, there also are different types of jury trials. But the basic difference between a jury trial and a bench trial is in a jury trial, a certain number of people from the community get chosen to listen to the evidence and decide whether the defendant is guilty or not guilty. And they're instructed by the judge that they should only find the defendant guilty if they're convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant committed all the elements of the offense that he or she is charged with. Now, how many people are on that jury is different depending on what level of offense we're talking about.
Interesting.
In Indiana, anyway.
My guess was there were 12, but maybe that's from the 12 Angry Men.
There often are 12. In Indiana, for an offense that's a level 5 or higher, so level 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 in murder, for those offenses, you get a 12-person jury unless you agree to have a smaller number. For level 6 felony cases, as well as misdemeanors, you get a 6-person jury. Either way, their verdict has to be unanimous. So all 12 of them either have to agree on guilty or agree on not guilty. And if they don't, then you have what's called a hung jury. And the trial is essentially then started over with a new jury on a different day. Now, that's how a jury trial works. A bench trial is where we don't have a jury, and instead the judge listens to the evidence and decides whether you're guilty or not guilty.
So going back to the jury trial, let's say that it's going to be a 12-person jury trial. I'm assuming more than 12 people show up for jury duty, or do just 12 people show up and you go with them?
No, and I don't know how many the jury pool in Mary County pulls on any given day where juries are scheduled, but I believe they send about 40 prospective out to each court, and that's kind of where they start. Individuals who are struck from one court may have to go and report to another court, but there have been times, at least in Marion County, where they did not have enough jurors.
Yeah, that happened to me, actually, in a trial I prosecuted. I had an aggravated battery case. It was a pretty serious one. The defendant, I don't have to say allegedly because he was convicted, but the defendant opened fire with an SKS on a group of people on Illinois Street at about 5 p.m. and shot from across the street. So the bullets were literally crossing the street in front of traffic and shot 3 people. And I had that set for trial. I don't remember the date anymore, but it was the Monday after the Colts' first Super Bowl appearance since they'd been in Indianapolis, right? It was 2007 or something. I think it was 2007, the 2007 Super Bowl, Colts and Bears. So literally everyone in the city was watching the Super Bowl. And, you know, that thing starts at like 7 or 8. It ends at like midnight or 1 in the morning. And who knows, for the partying, especially in Indianapolis, it was crazy here because we won and I had a jury in the morning. I think 12 or 14 people showed up for all the juries Marion County had that day on. And I think mine ended up being the only one
that went forward. Or?
Right. Every other prosecutor was probably like, I got to get this jury off my calendar somehow.
Right.
But 2007, Jake Rigney was like, oh, this is my job. I better do it. So I was ready to go. We did not have enough jurors. I think it was 12 or 14 showed up. 4 or 5 of them put on their questionnaire, I can't be fair and impartial. We did not impanel a jury. We ended up having to continue that trial.
So talking a little bit about how the jury is selected, say you have more than your 12 that show up, say like 14 come into your courtroom, do you have the opportunity to question them and select who's on your jury?
Absolutely, you do. Now, and it's something to keep in mind, we are going to speak from our experience in Marion County. I don't think either one of us have tried a case outside of Marion County. And we'll try and draw distinctions. Marion County does their trials very fast. In Marion County, you would be handed your juror questionnaires, which is front and back questionnaire, maybe 15 minutes before those 40 people walk into the room. They would be broken up into groups of 14, and you do it rounds in 14, and both sides get 20 minutes per round, and you talk, and it's a gut feeling. You get a minute to review each questionnaire, and then you're asking people questions. The reason why that's different, other counties, you may get the questionnaires a week in advance, and those people, they're looking at Facebook pages, they're running background checks on their own and things like that, trying to figure out who do they know in town, what connections do they have, and that's not a reality that you have practicing in Marion County. I think the theory is the same, but there's a wide variance between your ability to put those goals and things to practice.
Yeah, in Marion County, I don't want to say that you're just kind of winging it, but because you're not just winging it. You know all sorts of things from experience of having done it, but you don't get a lot of time to look into all these folks. You just kind of draw what conclusions you can from what's on the questionnaires, and then if you're still on the fence about them, you ask them some questions and try to figure out where they fall on a particular issue, and you go from there. Sometimes when you look at the questionnaires, I already know this person is either going to be fine for me or this person, I'm going to strike this person. But there's a lot of potential jurors that just don't put a lot of interesting stuff on their questionnaires. Not every person is like this crazy, interesting person who's lived the wild and crazy life. A lot of people are just like, I'm an electrician. I fix things that run on electricity. If the state proves it, I'll find him guilty. No, if the state doesn't prove it, I'll find him not guilty.
Yeah, it's not very insightful.
Right. And it's like, but how are you going to vote on it? I don't know. Like, and you can't ask them how they're going to vote on your case anyway, because they don't know. But, and so don't get me wrong, there is nothing wrong with being not interesting. Most days I wish my life was less interesting. But it can make for difficult jury selection when you don't know what to ask. Sometimes I just start asking about their personal life. You know, so how long have you been an electrician? Do you like it? You know, and then sometimes the way they respond to those questions gives you an idea of a little bit more about what kind of person they are. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So what if you don't like any of the potential jurors? Can you strike them all, or is there a limit to the number that you can...
You've got a limit. You got to pick. On the major felonies, you get 10 each. Side gets 10, and those are peremptory challenges, and you can do those for any reasons as long as they don't violate core constitutional protections. For instance, you can't go in and strike every black juror, potential juror, and those are rights of the juror not to be discriminated against. But then there are for cause challenges. For instance, if you were a victim of a child molest and you said, look, you know, it was you're potentially on a child molest, like I can't be fair, that person could likely be struck for cause, and then neither party would have to use one of their strikes. They don't fit, so nobody has to use a strike.
So after your jury is selected, what comes next?
Instructions.
And who are those instructions to, and what do they say?
What do they say? Well, the jury instructions are the instructions to the jury on what's going to happen, how it's going to happen, and how some points of the law are included. But they're instructions for the jury. It's the jury's guide on what they're going to do. Many people have never been there. What would you do? Well, your guide are the jury instructions.
Typically after jury selection, lunch is often the very next thing. But then instructions, yeah, and then opening statement.
Who's instructing the jury? Is it the prosecutor, the defense attorney, the judge?
The bailiff. The judge reads the instructions, but one of the things I guess we didn't go over, maybe so exciting, pretrial motions and instructions. And these are things that are done outside of the jury. And it's where, you know, we decide the final decisions about what evidence the jury will actually ever see and hear. You fight that out. But instructions, they have pattern instructions that, okay, these type of case have standard set of instructions. And then the attorneys get to submit proposed instructions on issues that they think need to be addressed specially. Now, you don't just get submit whatever you want and it goes on. There's a process for the other party to respond, and there can be argument on then. But as always, the judge is the final decision maker.
Could you give us an example of an instruction?
Well, they'll give you the definition of a reasonable doubt is one of the big things in Indiana, because I've heard other states they will not give you. This all comes down to, have you proven this person guilty beyond a reasonable doubt? In Indiana, they will give you a written definition of that. And in other states, I'm told that you're not. And then those people not only have to figure out, well, what evidence is credible? Do we believe these witnesses or not? Then they also have to figure out what really is the standard, what is enough.
Yeah, the Indiana instructions on what beyond a reasonable doubt means are, I mean, I don't want to call them funny because it's not really funny, but it is like a 4 or 5 sentence statement that is just lawyered the crap out of, right? So they start with, you have to be firmly convinced of the defendant's guilt, because there are almost nothing that you know to a certainty, and the state doesn't have to prove it to a certainty. But on the other hand, they do have to prove it more than probably. And so I don't know how many jurors would be confused before they read it, and I don't know how many of them are still confused after they've read it. It doesn't really come up a lot when I've talked to jurors afterward, but we give them this explanation. Does it help? I don't know. Maybe.
So after the instructions and lunch.
Lunch is important, especially when you skip breakfast.
Yes. Then we go to opening statements. And who's up first? Is it the state? Is it the defense?
No, the prosecution goes first. In opening, and then the defense follows if they choose. The defendant doesn't have to give an opening statement. Technically, the state doesn't either. It's rare for a lawyer to ever take the opportunity to not talk.
Right.
So it's really rare that they pass on opening statement, but it has happened. And you kind of say, especially the defense can kind of say whatever they want, because a lot of times they're not presenting a lot of evidence, so there's not really a lot of evidence for them to preview, which is typically the purpose of opening statement. It's to explain to the jurors what they should expect to see over the rest of the trial. So as a defense attorney, you just kind of, it depends on what kind of case you have, but you can lot of times there's not a lot of evidence to preview, and so you just sort of say, pay close attention, please, or something similar to that.
Who would take the stand to testify at a criminal trial?
Witnesses. any witness that has relevant information and is deemed competent. Generally, a police officer is one witness in almost anything from, a traffic ticket up to the highest felony. If there's a civilian victim, you would need to produce that person.
Do police typically show up for trials and court?
Typically, yes. The only time when a victim doesn't show up for the trial is when they're dead.
That would make sense.
Like, they don't bring the dead body into court.
That's
in case you're
good.
Wondering about that. The police usually appear when subpoenaed. I'm not going to say that they always do, because they don't always, but usually they do. And the more serious the case, the more likely they are to show up.
Can the prosecutor call the defendant to the stand?
No. That's your right to remain silent. That is your right from the investigation through trial.
Now, how does questioning the witness look? Does it ever look like the scene from the movie A Few Good Men, where the prosecutor is yelling at the witness on the stand and the witness yells back, "You can't handle the truth"? Like, does it ever look like that?
Okay. I think you mixed up your movie.
Well, she didn't, but she mixed up the roles. Like, Tom Cruise is not the prosecutor in A Few Good Men.
What is it?
She said 12 Angry Men. Did I mix it up?
I mentioned 12 Angry Men earlier. Here I said A Few Good Men.
Right.
Okay, my bad.
Tom Cruise is the defense attorney in A Few Good Men. He is defending the two Marines, the underlings who allegedly, I should say allegedly, who executed the Code Red. And then the argument, Tom Cruise's argument, was that Jack Nicholson ordered them to do the Code Red, and so they were just following orders. Tom Cruise is literally putting forward that I was just following orders defense in that trial, which is a terrible defense, by the way. But he was cross-examining a witness that I believe he called, because the state did, the prosecution didn't call that witness, but he was trying to prove that the officer's superiors ordered them to do that. And Nicholson did not want to admit it. And then eventually he did admit it. But, in the classic, "You're goddamn right, I ordered it." does it ever look like that? I mean, a little, maybe it can. It typically does not. It is typically a much more subdued situation. Witnesses are usually prepared for these types of events, and it's usually explained to them that acting the way that Jack Nicholson acts in A Few Good Men is a very bad idea. And the reason it's a bad idea is because when you're all riled up and angry, you say shit that you shouldn't say. And so I think typically lawyers for both sides will instruct their witnesses, it doesn't matter what kind of tone the other lawyer takes with you. It doesn't matter how they act. They might act like they don't like you. They may act like a smartass. They may insult you. They may be demeaning. Ignore the tone and answer the question, and you'll get off the stand quicker. And that's usually a big selling point for witnesses. It does not happen very often. I'm not going to say it's never happened, because I think it has, but
if someone yells like that, like they did in that movie scene, could they be held in contempt? And what does being held in contempt look like? Are you taken off to jail? Or are you slapped with a fine?
Well, I mean, there's not going to be a bright line. One's going to depend. I mean, it's the judge. And each judge I've ever been in front of, they are going to take each situation on its own. And what they may tolerate in a traffic ticket trial and what they might tolerate in, you know, a child molester, a rape or something, would be different. You know, you want to keep the decorum, but, you know, most judges understand these are highly emotional and, you know, may get a warning or kicked out. You can be found in contempt. And if you're actually found in contempt, you can do 6 months without credit, up to 6 months, or is it 90 days?
No, I think it's more, but the contempt rules in Indiana are weird and they aren't used very often. I think you can get up to a year, just the judge can just point at you and say, you're in contempt of court, and he can give you up to a year.
On the spot, right there?
No credit time.
Yeah.
Bailiff come get you, cuff you, you're off behind bars for a year?
The bailiffs typically don't have handcuffs. It would be a deputy, but yeah. yes, and they take you into the back and process you in from there after they take you through the tunnel under the city-county building over to the jail. But you can be punished even worse than that. But when you get to felony-level punishments, you have the right to a trial. So then you have to get accused, and the judge has to impanel a jury, and they have to call witnesses to determine so that a jury can determine whether you are in contempt or not. And there's also a difference between direct contempt, which is what you're talking about, where you're in the courtroom and you're doing something you're not supposed to do, and indirect contempt of court, which is, for example, not obeying a subpoena or something else like that. And the standard of proof and the requirements for evidence are different depending on which one you're using too, because it's all on the record when the judge is just pointing at you, right? So typically everyone can hear what the person did and it's easily reviewable. But indirect contempt, where you're out in the world somewhere and you're not responding to the judge, there might be innocent explanations for that. So there are more procedural safeguards in that situation.
How long does the typical criminal trial last? And I'm sure it depends on what type of case it is.
And again, in Indiana jurisdiction, you know, regularly in Marion County will knock out jury trials in one day. You know, a murder might take up to a week, but Jay can speak more on that. But
yeah, so it's... It's very different depending on the type of case, and there are even some other factors. I don't think anybody does a murder case in one day anymore, and probably not an attempt murder case either. Although I might have done one that only lasted a day before I left the prosecutor's office, but it was real simple. It was like on video. I don't remember whether that one went one or two, but most cases that are a level three or below may be tried in a day, but often go 2 days. Murder cases can run anywhere from 2 to 3, 4, 5 days. But the reality is there is no limit. There is no sort of hard stop. The state has to stop presenting evidence. There's no rule like that. So, like the David Bissard case in Fort Wayne, I think that trial took 6 weeks or 2 months.
Wow.
And there have been federal cases that have gone on even longer than that. Just months sometimes. There's a movie, a Vin Diesel movie about one, right? Like I think it was called Find Me Guilty, where Vin Diesel plays a guy who represented himself in like a big mafia trial with like 30 defendants or something. So 30 different lawyers get to cross-examine every witness and it takes forever. That trial probably took months.
Is there a time limit for the jury to deliberate?
There's not a hard time limit. You know, again, a judge and his or her experience and wisdom will know when communicating with them, when they're going to call it for, you know, a hung jury if they can't meet. It's not necessarily uncommon that jurors will come back and say they can't reach a verdict, but be sent back to continue deliberating. And that's one of those things, you know, yeah, you may have been here for a day and you're sitting for 4 hours. Well, maybe if this is a complicated case that's been pending for a year and a half, the judge isn't going to call a do-over because you guys think you're done in 4 hours. It's hard work, and the judge will put your feet to the fire to try and hash it out. And if it can be done, they want it done.
So I think, Jake, you mentioned a hung jury earlier in this podcast. Mm-hmm. If there is a hung jury, you said that the trial starts over.
Right. So when the jury cannot reach a unanimous verdict, a mistrial is declared. Essentially, once the judge determines that the jury is hopelessly deadlocked, they're just never going to agree. And so then the judge resets it for trial again. There are probably judges in Marion County who could turn that around and restart the trial the next day. Typically, it just gets reset in due course in a month or two and try it again.
So what happens after the jury reaches their verdict?
They let someone know, and then the verdict, everybody gets brought back, and the verdict gets brought in and handed to the judge. I think Jake talked about it before. You know, nobody knows what the deliberations happens in the deliberations. No one knows what the verdict is until it's read in open court when everybody is there.
Right. So there's in the trial, the state and the defense will call a series of witnesses. And the defense doesn't have to call anyone. And so after all the witnesses have been called, both parties do closing arguments. Closing arguments in Indiana are a little bit tricky because the state gets to go first and last. They're granted that because they have the burden of proof. So they get the final word in the trial about what's happened. After closing arguments, there is final instructions. Final instructions are another series of instructions about essentially what the jury should do during deliberation and reminding them about sort of what the elements of the offenses are and things like that. After that, a bailiff is sworn, and the bailiff, who is not a guy with a badge and a gun, but is sort of a person wearing normal clothes, swears an oath to keep the jury sequestered, to not let anyone communicate with them other than the bailiff. And the bailiff's job is to communicate the jury's messages to the judge. And then the judge will disseminate them to the lawyers for the parties. So the jurors retire to the jury room. They have a little button that they can push, which is a buzzer. And when they push it, the bailiff has to go find out what they want. Sometimes they have questions. If they have questions, they'll be instructed usually to write them down so that the judge can then show it to the lawyers and keep it as part of the record. And then sometimes the jury buzzes and says, we have a verdict, or says, we're not going to reach a verdict. We will not agree. And that can take... Yeah, I've had him go into another day before where the judge sends him home and has him come back to keep deliberating.
Do they go to their homes, and are they like, couldn't they talk to anybody if they go to their homes? Are they sworn you can't say anything?
They are. That's what happens. They are allowed to go home unless they've been sequestered, and that does not typically happen. It could happen with media cases. But typically the jury is free to go home. They are ordered by the judge not to discuss the case with anyone, and not discuss the status of deliberations with anyone. And then they come back and they keep going.
It's one of those things that I found through my jury experiences that when people are there and they're selected for the responsibility, it's really impressed on them the power of the court and the power that's in their hands. And they have to raise their hand and swear to the court that they're going to honor those. And most people do. Most people do. Even if going in, they say, I don't want to judge someone, or I don't want to be here, or I have this. When you go through the process, I think most people stand up and do what's right.
Can a jury ask to see evidence?
They can. And in fact, sometimes the judge just sends the exhibits back with the jury so that they can look at them if they want to. Sometimes they don't, though, and some judges categorically refuse to send the exhibits back for any reason. Sometimes the judge will allow for you to set the exhibits back up in the courtroom and have the jury walk through and look at them again if they have questions about what something shows. One thing they usually do is make sure to keep the firearms away from the ammo.
That's smart.
Because, look, firearms get admitted into evidence, and the ammo does too sometimes, but they always want to keep them both away because tensions can run hot during jury select or during jury deliberations, and people disagree angrily sometimes about different aspects of a trial. And the last thing you want is somebody turning something into a murder weapon again.
Right.
Because that would be a logistical nightmare, how to make it an exhibit in two different trials.
Now, if a defendant is not found guilty, what happens to that person?
He'd be brought back to the jail and processed out.
And if a defendant is found guilty, is the jury sentencing the defendant?
No. If the defendant is found guilty, the case is typically set for a sentencing hearing. And the judge decides what the sentence will be, unless it's a death penalty case. In a death penalty case, the jury reconvenes and hears additional evidence to determine whether the death penalty should be imposed or not. But in all other types of cases, including regular murder, it's the judge that issues a sentence. And it's usually not the same day. It could be for like misdemeanors, but even the last misdemeanor jury I did, they set it out for sentencing on a different day.
So that wraps up the trial aspect of this. Do you agree? Or did I miss?
No, it sounds something? So easy, doesn't it?
It did sound pretty easy.
We explained it all in like 40 minutes.
Well, one fun thing we didn't talk about, and I say fun because I like juror questions.
Nothing is fun. Nothing is fun about this job. Nothing.
A lot of lawyers hate them.
Nothing.
One of the things in Indiana, and this is a quote-unquote new thing, this was new when I was a very young attorney, so I don't have experience with jurors not being able to ask questions. But during the trial, state will question, defense will question, and when the lawyers are done, they'll say, jurors, do you have any questions?
For the person on the stand?
Correct.
Absolutely.
Those written questions are submitted to the judge. The lawyers get to look at them. We, you know, decide whether is it an appropriate question. Because sometimes they ask questions that, you know, we cannot, as lawyers, we didn't ask because the lawyers don't, the rules don't allow it. But I always try to read into those and gauge where is the jury's head at. Now, the other thing where they can inquire during deliberations as well, and you could be brought back to re-argue an issue while the jury is deliberating.
Yeah, that happened. I've done that, actually. I did that on like my first or second major felony jury trial. And this is why I don't drink during deliberations. A lot of...
Do you drink during opening statements?
No, but here's the thing, right? There's this sort of old, well-worn, like, I don't know if it's a tradition, but it's a perception that if the attorneys and the judge all like each other, they're all being civil, they're all doing their jobs. And then while the jury deliberates, they all go have a drink while they wait, right? The judge, the defense attorney, the prosecutor, they all go have a drink together. But I do not drink while I'm waiting for a verdict because the judge could make me argue some more. And I do not want to be going in front of the jury with any booze on my breath. Now, I don't drink anymore anyway. I quit drinking like a year ago. But even when I was drinking, I did not drink while I was waiting for the jury to come back with a verdict because of that.
Interesting. So we are now going to interrupt this episode and bring you the latest Florida Man news. Daily News reports that naked Florida man, he's naked again.
It's hot down there.
It is hot and things get sticky.
Naked Florida man was caught on video knocking on a 7-year-old's window in the middle of the night on numerous occasions.
This guy is going to get tased.
Well,
probably deserves more.
Right? The parents of the young Florida girl got a disturbing surprise after they installed a security camera. They learned that a naked neighbor was trespassing on their property almost every night and was repeatedly knocking on their 7-year-old's bedroom window. Florida man, who's 50, he was arrested and charged with aggravated stalking and trespassing. The girl's parents became suspicious that someone had been on their property earlier in the month, and they decided to install some security cameras outside. And the cameras captured the pervert calmly walking around the property, knocking on the child's bedroom window at least three separate nights the week they installed the camera. Florida man, who is described as a professional nudist, even removed...
Wait. One does not simply say professional nudist and then move on.
I don't know.
With the news story.
What does that mean?
Who pays him to be nude? How does one become a professional nudist?
Maybe the professionalism came with the fact that he does it often and he does it calmly and with confidence.
Is he certified? Do you need an associate's for that? Is there an exam you have to take?
I think it's a self...
Are there recertification procedures for becoming a professional nudist? Do you have continuing nudist education? I have a lot of questions about professional nudism.
He's a pervert and he's simply trying to legitimize it. Is it?
Yeah, well, the self-proclaimed professional nudist even removed the screen from the window of the girl.
Welcome to my nightmares. This is all I'm going to dream about for the next 4 days.
Yeah, now the sheriff praised the child's parents for taking it upon themselves to catch their creepy neighbor. But the sheriff said things would have ended up differently if it was his daughter's window being knocked on. He doesn't think the guy would end up being arrested. It would have been lucky.
No, he would have gone to the morgue.
Right.
Now, and that's the kind of thing that, I mean, I think there would be a lot of jurors that wouldn't have a lot of heartburn if alternative actions were taken. Yeah. I don't feel like I'd have much heartburn if an alternative choice was made by those parents.
Yeah, it's one of those weird things, right? Because, and I know I say that phrase probably in every podcast, but... you expect that criminal defense attorneys are going to get on a podcast and they're going to hear a story like this and they're going to say, well, remember, he's got the, you have to presume that he's innocent. Just because the parents say it's on video doesn't mean that he was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. We're reasonable human beings. We do not want people in any community walking around naked and banging on 7-year-old girls' windows. That's not why we do this job. It's not so that we can, okay, or boys, either one. I mean, we don't do this job because we want to help dudes like that get away with it. That's not that we do this job because the Constitution says that everyone has the right to a defense. And if we don't honor it for everyone, then we're not honoring the Constitution. You know, it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the naked guy banging on the window. But we're not his attorney. So, and most of the people out there, including like 100% of my clients that I actually represent, they don't want that guy around either. Most of them have daughters.
Right.
They're not mad at us right now for saying, hope he goes to jail. So we're not losing it. It's not like we're going to lose clients because we want the pervy guy who's naked and banging on windows to go to jail. Everybody wants that. It's not controversial.
Yeah, so Florida man, he was released on bond, but authorities said that there was a restraining order issued prohibiting him from stepping on his neighbor's property. Like a restraining order against the person that lives next door? That's like too close. How's that?
Well, look, he has property. So you tell him he can't live on his own property, you're essentially taking his property away from him. At the same time, it is feasible that you could live next door and have no contact. I've had neighbors that I barely met or didn't really know. So it's potentially workable.
Well, in Indiana, you know, I don't think that would get you a 1,000-foot restriction, but I mean, there are distance requirements that come along with sex crime. So, you know, in this, it doesn't sound like there was physical contact, but I'm not familiar with Florida's laws, but I mean, that's what post-conviction, you know, you would expect that distances could make somebody move, or, you know, whether they don't have to sell their property, but they could say you can no longer reside in that house because it's too close to the victim.
Yeah, in Indiana, there are rules like that, especially for rape and child molest. So in that situation, he'd have to move after his conviction.
But that's the difference between pretrial and post-conviction, because he retains the presumption of innocence and he gets the no contact or order pre-conviction. But then it could be a different world once he is convicted.
I might put up an electric fence.
Well,
I don't know.
If you do, do everyone a favor and put a sign on it that says what it is, because some people try to climb it.
So the Sun Sentinel reports that three Florida men are behind bars for burglarizing over 30 homes, and it couldn't have been easier to find them. Why? Because they carried out the crimes while wearing ankle devices.
Right, they're on monitoring while they're doing it.
Yeah, the three Florida men committed these crimes already on pretrial release for previous crimes. And they were out wearing court-ordered GPS ankle monitors.
Yeah, this is not confined to the brilliance of Florida criminals. I remember being a prosecutor and being privy to an initial hearing on a gentleman, and the judge actually turned his chair around, so you could tell he was laughing, but he was not audibly laughing because the gentleman stole a functioning GPS unit. Now, it was alleged to have cost about $60,000, so that's why he took it. But, of course, when it was gone, they just looked at it and then went and got him.
Oh, my gosh.
Was it what? Cocaine's a powerful drug.
Right. The trial I mentioned earlier, the attempt murder that we might have gotten done in one day, that defendant was on electronic monitoring, and he went to a strip club and saw somebody he didn't like there and tried to shoot him in the park. Did shoot him, but didn't kill him in the parking lot. Yep. And he also, this strip club has had so many problems, they make everyone present their ID to us to a security camera. Like, so they put it under a camera before they'll let him in. So we had him there ahead of time, providing his ID, plus we had the tracking from his ankle bracelet showing that he was there, and then he left, and then he came back, and then he left again very quickly. You get mad and you don't think.
Right.
And nobody does these things with the thought that they're going to get caught. They're acting in the heat of the moment, at high emotion. I mean, sometimes people are just downright dumb, but usually there's some contributing factors to that as well.
And that's all the time we have for today.
All right. Thanks, Terry. And thank you, listeners, for listening to Tales from the Brown Desk. Please remember, while we may discuss legal issues and provide information regarding the law to our listeners, we do not intend to create an attorney-client relationship with any listener. Our advice may not be applicable to some legal issues. Please consult with an attorney you have hired to review your legal situation before you attempt to apply the things we have said to your case. Also, you can ask us questions. Just email Terry, that's T-E-R-I, at RigneyLawIndy.com, and entitle your email podcast question, and we'll read it on our next podcast. Unless we start getting too many questions, and then we'll just read the good ones. Obviously, we never get more than one question a week, and that's okay. Shout out to Fort Wayne, though. Thanks for the question, bruh. Sorry to hear about your troubles. Buzzsprout says we have 17 listeners.
What?
Yeah.
What happened?
Our ratings are plummeting.
What are our European listeners?
I think France is holding on.
Thank you, France. We need you.
Israel is gone.
Oh, was that an accent?
Montreal, Quebec, gone.
Oh.
Sacre bleu. Boardman, Oregon, still there. Washington, Virginia, who I'm pretty sure is Cassie's sister, also still there. We do have a new listener, I think from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Probably a relative of mine. That's where my dad was born. Seriously, someone get me some water. 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 There we go. That's it. The attorneys at Rigney Law do not comment on their current pending cases. Nothing we have said in this podcast is a comment on a case we are currently working on, even if your name is Chad or you love QAnon conspiracies. Okay, bye.